and the various choices or strategies arising, I think, are I'll change the dynamics and thereby secure a definite macro realm. And that obviously means, in effect, models of the collapse of the wave packet. And there's a list of folk who have been involved. Pearl since the 60s, Gissin, GRW, early 80s onwards. First of all, 90s, Penrose believes that gravity will be involved. And I didn't put it on the slide, but I would recommend a tour de force by Stephen Adler called Quantum Theory as an Emergent Phenomenon, a CUP book of 2004, which is quite extraordinary, kind of virtuoso, unique other way of doing it. In fact, I just blow the trumpet of a journal. So, Adler, a CUP book of 2004 or 5 called Quantum Theory as an Emergent Phenomenon. And there's a review of it by Pearl. I don't know whether it's on the archive, but it's in this noble journal. Which I recommend to anybody who's a bit interested in the history and philosophy of quantum, called the Studies in the History and Philosophy of Modern Physics. So there's a, if you can't afford the time or money for Adler's monograph, you can read a survey of it by Pearl. The second option would be, and this is, as I said earlier, it's rather schematic and questionable, these taxonomies, but it is true that Wigner at one stage suggested, and Stapp has since the mid-80s advocated repeatedly, the idea that despite my doubts and the gentleman at the front's doubts, that you shouldn't get the mind-body problem involved in the foundations of physics, that yes, consciousness does collapse the wave packet. There's an evolving superposition of the system, entangling ever larger parts of the environment as time goes on. But when we get to the mind-body interface, there is a collapse. Now, the nature of that collapse as an event in space and time is left very schematic by Wigner, and I must admit I haven't kept up with that. And I of the three noble, I said there were three noble traditions, I mean the other three. I really don't give any credence at all to this view. So the other option is, of course, to say there's a definite macro realm, but we need to attribute extra values while keeping the dynamics unitary. And the most best established and thus best developed, most detailed tradition there is the pilot wave, devised by de Broglie and reinvented with experts by Bohm in 1952. And, while we're talking about where else to read or good books, there are two books from 1993. Bohm and Heide have a book called The Undivided Universe. And Peter Holland, who was their research student, has a book called The Quantum Theory of Motion, which is a rather telling, provocative title, but I think it's subtitled The Causal Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. The pilot wave and causal are both used as names for this. This is Routledge, and this other one by Holland is CUP, and they're both 1993. And for lack of time, I'll say no more about it, except it's a very honorable tradition. Maybe you can take it up in tutorial groups. I'll also say that it's not the only thing under this scheme. Some of you will have come across the modal interpretation of quantum mechanics, which has various versions, but it's certainly under that category. And I'll say a tiny bit more about the modal shortly, I think. And then finally, there's the Many Walls interpretation of Everett and others, in which, as I've written, you say, which we haven't yet said, that there is a quantum state for the universe, which is indeed a bold thing to say. And it's so bold that you normally honorifically give it a capital Psi, right, to indicate the boldness of your posture. But you then say that it is a superposition of states corresponding to many different definite macro realms, that the different branches arising from Schrodinger cat-like situation are to be regarded as all equally real, and they're in that sense, well, actual and real are pretty much synonymous. And then there has to be a special story about why there's a definite appearance. Okay. Now, as I said in my announced scheme for today, I hope to say more about Many Worlds a bit at the end. Okay. Yeah.
Depending on how you answer this, I have a follow up. Do you believe that those exhaust possibilities?
The four categories then do exhaust the possibilities in a trivial sense. Namely, I had two yes-no questions, and I think they're independent. Of course, the words in which I phrase those questions are vague, but if I make it a resolution of vagueness about what does it mean appearance, then any doctrine you might decide, like Everett, as he believed his theory in 1964, right? A certain doctrine hard to know now, quite how he thought of it, but it's going to fall somewhere in some taxonomy based on a resolution of the vagueness.
Okay, so since you said yes, where do things like, you know, Chris Brooks' phase interpretation, Carly Bell's relational interpretation fit in? Because I don't see your hands up there at all.
No.
And I don't know where to put them. Because I don't think it's either one.
Right. Any of those. Right. That is a very good question, and I don't know. I don't know whether Chris Brooks would like to comment at this stage. I don't want to put him on the spot.
Oh, I have an opinion, you know.
I value your opinion.
It's your talk, so keep moving on.
Okay. So anyway, homework exercise. If you can't catch Chris Brooks, calculate for yourself where he would have to be if Butterfield is right.
Please out the slide.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you personally subscribe to the first option? Am I understood right?
Well, to be honest, according to my in the long run will know the quantum theory is false, I do subscribe. But if you ask me what I would now work on if I wanted to work as a philosopher on interpretations or solutions to the measurement problem, so which I would say that the richest field now is the four. Right. I don't think that, for a philosopher. There are a lot of philosophical issues about Everett which are worth getting stuck into as a philosopher. There's a great many good, great physics issues in the third option. But it's not something I would expect to work on. That's just a piece of, you know, autobiography about me. Don't take it as having any cognitive value. That's just me. Yeah.
So what do you feel that the third option is really, in a scientific sense, that is what I can measure in the laboratory in the end, that is distinguishable from the orthodox Copenhagen interpretation? Since, these pilot waves are supposedly not measurable, and thus the whole approach debate tells the theorem. So it doesn't run afoul of Bell's theorem and the experimental limitation of
it. That's a good point. The short answer to this, without going into the details, because it would take 5 minutes, is that, in the pilot wave theory, as you all know, there are point particles, often called corpuscles, that have definite trajectories, so they wander greatly, but they are continuous in space and time, and they are guided by the unitarily evolving complex wave function. This is in the most basic case of pilot wave, which is non-relativistic many-particle quantum mechanics. In fact, the guidance is very straightforward. You resolve the quantum wave function into this form, you see, and so you have the phase S, and the gradient of S is P, so to speak, mx dot. And in fact, that's very like something that you will have come across in Hamilton-Jacobi theory in classical mechanics. So there's a sort of deep physical naturalness about this. So in any case, because there are these individual particles, the probabilities, and there's a determinism of how they move, and there's a determinism of how the wave moves, there is therefore a question, how on earth does this theory get probabilities? And the answer is that it gives you the Born rule for position, now understood in the way I was doing earlier for classical statistical mechanics probabilities, namely, the pilot waiver says that there is a probability over position of the corpuscle, which is regular, straightforward, classical, statistical, mechanical ignorance probability, and it's given by the Born rule. So the density, being a bit more explicit, is this. That's the probability density for position. Now, it turns out that with a kind of depth and beauty that you might find contrived, but it's certainly pretty striking, this theory, though ontologically so different from either the misty complementarity of Bohr that I haven't discussed, or the minimal instrumentalism of what I called orthodoxy, though so different, it is empirically equivalent to that, apparently, provided you maintain this ringed equation. In particular, as you said, you don't fall foul of Bell's theorem. However, it is true that you have the resources in this theory to imagine an ensemble of corpuscles that are not distributed probabilistically in accordance with mod psi squared, and then you can get deviations from quantum theory. And so it is, in principle, empirically distinguishable. Right. And this is quite an important thing to announce, because I think most people would want to now accept, insofar as willing to discuss, by the way, Tor as a serious contender, they would accept that you've got to admit that in the background motivational talk of pilot wave, having this in equation is conceptually coherent. And you then can give arguments that it will be a short-lived in equation, that there will be a certain kind of mixing that leads to this, which on this view is now sometimes called quantum equilibrium. So it is in quantum equilibrium that the pilot wave theory will match the orthodoxy. But pilot wave theorists even toy with early universe quantum disequilibrium and think of finding now traces of it in cosmological data. So that's a quick answer. Yeah.
Two quick questions. First of all, is there a relativistic formulation of this? And second, you said it doesn't. You said it's consistent with Bell inequalities, and I would disagree with that because it's not local.
Okay. As to the second. Fear not, there will be peace between us. It depends what you mean by consistent with Bell inequality. As the first, I would say, as to relativity, there are various schools in the pilot wave theory in various locations with diverse views about how to develop it, in particular for relativity. The main answer would be that you can get, so far as, for example, these two books are concerned, and I haven't followed pilot wave theory very much recently, you can get the experimental statistics of Lorentz invariant relativistic quantum field theories, heuristic quantum field theories, for bosons and fermions. But that Lorentz invariant experimental statistics is weirdly phenomenological. The Lorentz invariance is a phenomenological symmetry.
It has to be.
There is actually a postulated fundamental frame. all in not a frame, there is a fundamental slicing of the space-time. There is an absolute simultaneity structure. And without my knowing anything about it, and therefore a fortiori, we're not going to go into it, even if we did have time, I can say that the reason there's this fundamental absolute simultaneity, even in the relativistic versions of the pilot wave, the reason is that it's a sense of basically a legacy of this guide, so-called guidance equation in the non-relativistic case. Because you notice that when you take the gradient here to know the velocity, this is in a many-particle system a function of the configuration space point, which is the positions of, as it might be, all three particles. So there's a three-particle system here. And in order to know the motion of the first, I take the gradient of this thing with respect to the one coordinates. But when I do that, the point in configuration space at which I take this gradient is the point corresponding to the actual positions at that time of the other two particles. So the exact location somewhere in space of the rest of the system, the other two particles, is determining at which point in the complex value functions on configuration space I take this gradient. And that is an action at a distance on the individual case basis. In the individual case of a particular system, this thing is sensitive to where the other guys are. Okay, it, as regards its velocity. And that's a kind of, that non-locality, this leads to your second question, is how non-relativistic pilot wave theory avoids Bell's theorem. Namely, it is non-local in that sense. And in the mid-80s, using computer simulations, there were some rather beautiful pilot wave papers, which showed a very explicit pilot wave description of a Bell EPR type experiment with stone Gerlach apparatuses in which you would recover the orthodox quantum probabilities, i.e. you would not be subject to a Bell theorem, you would not be committed to the Bell inequalities, you would recover the orthodox quantum probabilities because of this non-locality.
Yeah,
okay. Is that all right?
I just didn't understand
this. Okay, so in a way your first question about can it be relativistic led to the answer to the second, because there is an absolute simultaneity in this framework, so far as I know it, and it does underpin the avoidance of the evasion of Bell's theorem. Great, thanks. Okay. Yeah.
What is an interpretation? say an empirical point of view. What does it mean?
Yeah. This is a very good question, at least so it seems to me. And on the other hand, I think the answer is probably in a certain debating or dialectical context, it can be really worth making it precise. But for a lot of the time, it's worth having it just as a word that comes and goes, flows a bit with vagueness, because it's useful in debate often to not, you can't make every word precise. So. What philosophers would tend to say is that there's a formalism in a physical theory, and then to connect it with reality, you have physical words getting attached to this formalism, and those physical words are the interpretation. Things obviously get a bit murky ever since 10:15 this morning, because we're now involved in effect saying we have a formalism. Many people, I guess all the people who came here this week, think there's something awry or even wrong with the formalism as we have it and the way we and all the way we think about it. So interpretation is really, you know, an attempted answer to that cluster of questions. But it can involve, therefore, changing the formalism. That's what the dynamics people do. Or indeed, you might say, this is changing the formalism. This is a subtle question, or rather, not subtle, but a delicate question. when you look at a wave mechanics textbook, they will typically introduce a probability current for non-relativistic quantum mechanics. This probability current is essentially this equation. It's just that they don't write down this equation, but when they write down the current and you look at its flow lines, it's this equation. So some pilot wave advocates emphasize, hey, don't say the pilot wave is a new formalism. A very fine physicist turned philosopher called Jim Cushing, who died 6 years ago, 5 years ago, he emphasized that in non-relativistic case, the pilot wave theory didn't have a revision of formulas. So I hope that answered a little bit. Yeah.
I want to ask questions regarding the measurement problem at the start of the talk. You are assuming that the electron or the system, and also the apparatus, is a closed system, and the outer was not part of the interaction. So the question is, where is the observer in this picture?
So when I was setting up the measurement problem, I assumed it was closed. So you're making this comment that I assumed it was closed.
You were assuming the electron and the apparatus together forms a closed system and they didn't evolve on the parent.
Yes.
But where is the observer in this picture?
Right. Yeah, that is, I don't think there's a problem for me, but your question helpfully, it brings out the way I was thinking about it. When I said the final state is not an eigenstate of point or position, exclamation mark, and then I didn't write down explicitly, and I apologize, I should have written down something like, we want to have a definite point or position. We want to have a definite macro realm, is how I summarized that. Well, when I did that, I was more or less saying, and this was before def ac got on the table as another possibility. I was just going along with the everyday common sense view that you want a definite macroscopic realm. When I was doing that, I was really saying, I don't want an essential role for the observer. I want to get that pointer to have a definite position, and then 2 days later, an observer could come along, could look, and it would be classical psychophysics that would explain how that observer acquired his beliefs. Does that answer the question? I was really going with not involving fundamentally the observer. And it's you're right that there's a whole tradition from the 20s onwards that the measurement problem is a mistake because of the fundamental role of the observer. But this only becomes very explicit, and I would say clear-headed and vivid, in something like Widner and Snap. But then I find it just unbelievable. So I hope that answers it.
No, I have to go on from
that. Okay. Sorry.
To refer back to my earlier question, how does that go along with observables that don't have any eigenstates at all?
Like, sorry, how does what go along with that?
Like the interpretation of all the eigenstates having assuming values. I mean, there are observables, if you give a continuous spectrum, there are no eigenvectors at all. So how does that interpretation happen?
I think I think there's a two-part answer. They're both of them rather unsatisfying, actually. But what I would say is there's a very programmatic technical answer that much of the discussion could be carried over to continuous spectrum observables. Okay, but I won't go into detail. But I think it could. But the second murkier answer, which would get my perhaps satisfy you, is to say one of the things that I think most people in the game of solving the measurement problem would accept is that it is not necessary to announce at the beginning of your solution some quantity Q as having a definite value or having a definite value far beyond what orthodoxy allowed, and it must always be precisely Q which has it. it would be enough that it be an observable that's in some sense close to Q. So, as I said when I talked about decoherence on that first slide, I said we get a mixture of states that are close to position eigenstates. And of course, when you've done wave mechanics, you've seen the approximate position eigenstate of relatively well-localized wave packet. It might well have infinite tails, some Gaussian or something, but most people in the game of solving the measurement problem or interpreting quantum theory would probably say that if they can get definite position in this sense of albeit with tails, that would be enough.
Okay, but under time evolution, the wave packet would spread.
Yeah, sure.
Compared to the eigenstate.
Sure, yes. So wave packet spreading it's a universal, ubiquitous phenomenon. And I have to admit to you that in the 1960s through to 1980s, that is the kind of third period of foundations that my couple of hours is sort of emphasizing, there was discussion of hidden variables and so on by the philosophers and the quantum logicians and avoiding the Bell's theorem and the Cochin-Specker proofs and so on. And there tended not to be sufficient emphasis on you've got to get the right values, but you've got to keep having the right values over time. So the stability of your proposed solution to the measurement problem over time is an important consideration. Sorry, it's a rather unsatisfactory answer.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to, I think, not allow another hand to go up at this stage. now, at this point, I think I may do well to skip some slides at this point. I was going to talk about the project, well, perhaps I should just go through the slides a bit quicker, otherwise I'm going to lose some material. I ought to describe, if only for a minute, the projection postulate, or the collapse of the wave packet. And this is not in Bohr, but it is in people like von Neumann, Heisenberg, Dirac. It's worth putting up just once. There it is in good old English. If you measure a quantity on a system that is in the state V and you get the eigenvalue AK, which corresponds to the subspace big AK, then the state immediately after the measurement is not the V that you began with, but rather the projection of V onto AK, okay, divided by its own length in order to be a length vector of length 1. This is the projection postulate that is in countless textbooks. I imagine you've come across it before, and I would just remark that obviously, we've got indeterminism here. We've got also physical probabilities because the collapse or projection is undertaken with a Born rule probability given by the squared length of the projection of the vector into the subspace concerned. And this, of course, is what you need in your Christmas parties with your family and other friends. This is what you need to explain to everybody, is that they're going to say, oh yes, quantum theory, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, indeterminism, right? And you're going to say, as a foundations person, good thing you said that. Actually, it's a lot more subtle. And I don't think there's money in foundations to sort this out, because this indeterminism that everybody in the street has heard about in connection with quantum theory only, of course, enters at the most controversial part of the theory, namely in the theory of measurement, namely in the projection. So what I read on this slide was, can this thing be justified? I mean, there it is in the opening pages of Dirac or similar books, and there are various comments to make. First of all, what we would naturally ask is this, and this is, again, repeating my theme about mixtures, we would naturally ask, can a unitary evolution of a composite system induce a projection postulate evolution of a component? Now, as stated at the top, it's all about the microsystem. But as we have discussed, we don't ultimately care so much about, in philosophy or solving the measurement problem, about the destiny of the microsystem. We're more concerned to get a definite point of reading. So we, in a sense, what we want is a projection of the point into one of its position states, or, as I was saying to the gentleman, something close. In any case, can such a unitary evolution induce a projection posterior evolution on a component? Well, it looks like it can, but actually it's not interpretatively right. Intuitively, the mixtures that we're looking for should be ignorance interpretable, but what they will in fact only be improper. On the other hand, I would like to say that the projection postulate is empirically successful in certain, if measurements are repeatable. Of course, some measurements destroy the microsystem, like a spot on a photographic plate. And actually, my discussion is going to be limited in the sense that I will be talking about this kind of measurement represented by projectors. And I hope other lecturers will be talking about positive operator valued measurements or more general conceptions of measurement. But my slides are, in this sense, limited. And I can't therefore deal with a measurement that destroys the system with the apparatus of von Neumann and Dirac's discussion of using the projection postulate. But it is true that on this view, an immediately repeated measurement is certain to yield again whatever value was first obtained. And some measurements are indeed like that. So in that sense, the projection postulate looks empirically successful if you don't allow yourself to get confused about the measurement problem. It's also true that a natural operational definition of co-measurability of two observables is equivalent to mathematical commutation of them. And what is this definition of co-measurability? I'll say that I've done it for projectors here, but it's the proof corresponds to an arbitrary Hermitian operator or a self-adjoint operator. I'll say that PA and PB, to go with my notation on the slide, are co-measurable if it's true that if I were to measure PA and then immediately PB and then immediately after that PA, then although there might be variety in my first PA result, I'm bound to get on my second PA whatever I got first. So the PB that intervenes doesn't ruin the certainty to get what you first got, certainty to get on the second one what you happen to get on the first one. Okay. Now, if you do a little linear algebra with the projection postulate as it's stated at the top, you can show that for this co-measurability for all vector states V of PA and PB, you can show that that is pretty straightforwardly equivalent to PA and PB project being commuting, which means they have a common eigenbasis. So it's intuitively pretty straightforward that, you know, having a common eigenbasis means that once I'm in my PA eigen space from the first projection, I don't get thrown out of it by projection with PB. So my second PA measurement will again record for me, according to projection postulate, what I happen to get in the first. Yeah.
So improper mixtures come up again.
Yeah.
The reason I keep bugging you about this is because I don't think there's an actual difference, but that's my personal bias, so I was just wondering what your definition of.
Okay. I admire your tenacious. I'm not just admire, grateful, because you know, I did ask for hand signals to speed up, and indeed, I think I may not get onto non-locality, but I will at least get proper and improper fixture sorted out in 15 minutes. But I should stop it. We began at 10:40, but should I stop at 11:30? Okay. Well, anyway, it's evident that if you have two probabilities, so there's four things on this slide, right? First is a triviality. The second is something you've already said. The third is the real McCoy. The fourth is a warning. Okay, the real McCoy is the thing I've been kept advertising. But let's begin with the triviality. I just want to make the comment that if you take two probability distributions, you can make a convex combination of them, and it's a probability distribution. Right? The second point is that if you have a large, as they say in physics, ensemble, or as you might say more naturally, population. Of course, ensemble, I guess it's a French word, right? And this is Canada, so ensemble is a good word. Why did I say that? But in any case, you have a large ensemble of systems, and now here comes the buzzwords. It is a heterogeneous ensemble. It has subpopulations that are in different states. It is not a homogeneous population. It is a heterogeneous population. So you imagine that there are proportions lambda I that are described by various per I. Then the probability distribution for the entire ensemble will be given by the convex combination that we were discussing. Okay. And in quantum theory, you can imagine then, this goes back to our very initial question when we had this thing V, and the gentleman towards the front said, ah, but how do you ever know that something is in V? And I said, I assume my lab technician can supply me with a beam. And then we had to admit that a beam might be heterogeneous. It might have actually different systems in the beam in different states. So the pro I are given by vectors VI. Okay. So that's the idea of an ignorance interpretable mixture. In physical terms, I haven't given you any formalism for it, but that's the physical idea. Now, the thing I want to emphasize, though, is this stuff number three. So, the blue stuff is true and straightforward. The stuff below is important and is the punchline. And furthermore, it can be made green and therefore more vivid. And yet the cost of this is to make everything dark. So I don't that's a sort of compromise. Those of you who have done courses in classical optics will perhaps know why that's true, but I'd like to know from you later why it says. Okay, so the uncontentious blue is just the comment that obviously, as I was saying earlier, if you have a composite system, you would expect the state of that composite system to determine a state of its components. If I give you a complete description of the European Union, I thereby give you a complete description of France. So complete descriptions of composites include complete descriptions of their parts. Fine. Right. So that's the beginning. You've got an ensemble of composite systems. It's in some state. Maybe it's a mixed state. But that will determine states for the component systems. That's fine. Now comes the second part, the if-then. I want to make the comment that, so to speak, heterogeneity, non-homogeneity, is inherited by composites from their components. So imagine the lab technician comes in and, you know, this is like a quantum information community here. So we have 1,000 singlets. We've been given 1,000 singlets. And in fact, as many of you will know, the singlet determines as the component for the left particle a mixture which is half the identity matrix on C2. It's this. But we'll come to what these density matrices are in a minute. The main point is that the singlet is describing every pair in my population of 1,000. They're all in the singlet. And I can imagine perhaps it's a proton and an electron, so I don't have issues of just of identical or indistinguishable particles. So let all my left systems be protons. Fine. If you wish to say that my 1,000 protons in my bag of 1,000 singlets, if you wish to say that my 1,000 protons are a heterogeneous population, that there are different states represented there in the group of 1,000, then you will be just ipso facto, as we say in Latin. ipso facto, as we say in philosophy, you will just by, you know, it's the same fact. Ipso facto means it is the same fact. You will, if you have a heterogeneous collection of 1,000 protons in this bag of 1,000 singlets, you will then, never mind what you say about the electron, the right system, you will have a heterogeneous population of composite systems. That heterogeneity of the component has made your composite systems heterogeneous as well. They've got different kinds of left member, right? So that's what I'm saying. So if the component state is in an ignorance mixture, then the composite must be in an ignorance mixture, at least as regards that component. Now, it so happens that in quantum theory, a pure state that is for a composite system, which is entangled, it determines mixtures as the states of its components. There's a mathematical formalism called partial tracing, which goes you from state assignments to composites to state assignments to their components, just like deducing from the full description of the European Union a description of France. So this determination has the property that a pure composite state will in fact determine mixtures when it is an entangled state. And I'm saying they cannot be ignorance interpretable. If they could be, then that ignorance interpretation would be inherited upwards by the composite. But we said that the composite was in a pure state. And you might say, well, hang on, you said this composite was in a pure state, but couldn't a pure state like that be a mixture? And this is my fourth remark. Mixtures are always distinguishable from superpositions. Okay, so I just want to make the point here that if you have a pure state V of the familiar vector kind, and you've got a quantity Q for which it is a superposition, then yes, there is a corresponding mixture, thereby defined intuitively, namely V expanded in the VI basis as scalars CI, eigenstates VI, it determines rho, which is a mixture, we're getting now to the notation for mixtures, of being in VI with weight mod CI squared. That's a determination of a corresponding mixture, which I'm telling you just as a postulate, as a definition of what I mean by corresponding mixture. And they will give identical probability distributions for the quantity Q that I was concerned with, namely good old Born rule, namely you'll get the value I with probability mod CI squared. But if you chose another observable Q dash that doesn't commute with Q, then this mixture and the superposition with which you began will in general give different statistics. So mixtures are experimentally distinguishable, statistically distinguishable from superpositions. Yeah?
Just a quick comment. It seems then, as I sort of suspected from the way you're using it, that your definition of improper mixtures as distinct from proper mixtures relies on the assumption that maximal information about a system is also complete information. And that if you don't, if you decide that you can have maximal information about systems, that you can know a pure state that it's in, but that's nevertheless not complete information, then you can eliminate this distinction. Anyway, but that's...
I fully agree. You could eliminate it in the sense that you could say, when Butterfield and D'Espagnard are saying the mixture is improper, and going on about how weird it is and how it's not ignorance interpretable, there are other variables.
Outstrip
maximal information. It's inaccessible information.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that there are other variables. I'm saying that you can have ignorance without ignorance of something. I mean, you can have uncertainty without there being uncertainty of something underneath.
Ah, fine. Okay.
It's inherent.
I agree. In that sense, you would like to use the word ignorance to describe what I call an improper mixture.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's semantics at this point. I don't really want to get into the details because, you know, I'm sure Chris folks will have plenty to say on it. I just wanted to mention that what the distinction, I wanted everybody here to hear, that the distinction that you're making is perfectly valid in everything that you said. I agree with it. If you start with your postulates, you get this. But there's a hidden assumption that pure states are not only the maximal information about a system, which is pretty much undeniable, but they're also, in some sense, the actual state, complete information. And once you know the pure state, that's what it is. And I'm saying that if you don't have that equality between maximal information about a system and complete information, then you eliminate all these distinctions and you eliminate all these paradoxes. You know, you eliminate the confusion of how you could get a mixture out of something that was pure.
Okay.
but I don't want to go into it. I just want to say that there's a hidden assumption there.
Okay, that's very.
I'm just adding.
That's really good because it sets an agenda for some discussions by, well, at least the triangle of us three, hauling in, lassoing Fuchs.
I'm just
clarifying these matters for me. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so now let me just try and give you more formalism about the density matrix. Again, I'm going to perhaps run fast for lack of time, and it may be appropriate, having had a lot of controversial discussion, that this formalism stuff, which is, you know, it's always the truth of formalism. You either know it and don't need to hear it, or it's new, in which case it's rebarbative and indigestible. So that's the nature of formalism in a teaching context. You really need to kind of think about these things on a sheet of paper privately. But here we go then at some speed. I want to introduce familiar jargon, selective versus non-selective measurement. So if you have a projection postulate measurement of a quantity which is here called A for a system in a state, which V, which I've expanded in terms of the UN, the eigenstates of A, you ask what's the final state? Well, on a selective measurement, on with the projection cost would be one of the UN. But a non-selective measurement is where, as they say, you keep all the channels, you keep all the bins, you imagine 1,000 systems subjected to this, they come out with their Bornwell probabilities into the various UN, and you keep that whole group of 1,000, you don't select. Well, this would be then a proper mixture, an ignorance interpretable mixture of the UN with those weights. And I want to emphasize, this is the bottom of the last slide, this is not describable by V. Yes, V and this mixture have the same prescribed probabilities for an immediately repeated measurement of the quantity A, but not for a subsequent measurement of some B that doesn't commute with A. Well, okay. So it is possible to write down the Born rule in terms of not vectors, but projectors. And having done that, to adapt the formalism to mixtures of the kind we're now discussing. So let's see how that's done. Obviously, you're familiar with the trace, a basis independent functional, linear, and a tiny bit of algebra, which I haven't written down, is that this Born rule probability for getting AK, if you were to measure A in the state V, is actually the trace of a product of projectors. The projector onto V and the projector onto the eigenstate UK that you're concerned with. So the initial state is actually equally well represented not by the vector that we chose, but by the projector onto that one-dimensional ray that it generates. Okay, so now trace is linear and probabilities are, we're taking convex combinations and we've had the idea of a kind of sum with various weights, mod ci squared of being in vi in the previous slide. So here, again, we can introduce a convex combination of projectors onto one-dimensional spaces and we can think of that as representing an ensemble, heterogeneous, and the probability of getting a result will then be a trace of this W but multiplied by the projector onto the UK. The linearity of this of trace will mean that this will give the Born rule probability just as we want. So this is the density matrix here introduced, also called density operator, also called statistical operator. And therefore, we can write down what a non-selective projection postulate measurement of A would yield. It would yield this sum, convex combination of projectors. Right? The final mixture depends upon the quantity measured. If you measured B instead, you would have a different mixture. This mixture is what I called on the previous slide the corresponding mixture, given the superposition and the choice of a quantity. Okay. Once you've got the density matrix, you can say certain formal things about it, which I haven't got on a slide, but I better say them out loud. There's a bit of space up here. I've taken a convex combination of one-dimensional projectors. So it's a real linear combination of one-dimensional projectors. They're all Hermitian, so it's Hermitian. It's a convex combination of one-dimensional projectors, so actually its trace is 1. So it's a trace 1 Hermitian operator. Being Hermitian, you can do a spectral decomposition. And be warned, that is mathematically canonical. It's a basis-independent way of representing the density operator. But that doesn't mean that it represents the physical ensemble with which you were dealing when you first wrote down this density matrix. So the density matrix is, in a sense, a little bit deceptive. It fully encodes the Bornwell statistics for any measurement you want to make on your ensemble. But it does not tell you if this ensemble is truly heterogeneous and has these fractions or subpopulations. It doesn't tell you what that decomposition is. So I could take perfectly validly a convex combination of projectors onto, say, 3 mutually skew one-dimensional rows. Right? I could then do a spectral resolution of this density operator, and it will not give me back 3 mutually skewed rays. It will give me, because it's spectral decomposition, eigenvalues labeling orthogonal eigenspaces. So the spectral decomposition of a density operator doesn't necessarily represent the physics, though it is, of course, mathematically canonical in the sense of basis independent. Yeah?
I would disagree with that statement entirely.
That's
are correct. I mean, the density matrix, when you decompose, you can decompose the density matrix into an infinite number of ways, unless it's a pure state. But any mixed state can be decomposed in an infinite number of ways. There's many that are canonical, but an infinite number of ways to decompose them. Yet it's the density operator itself that encodes all the measure results. I agree with that completely. What I disagree with is the interpretation, because what you're saying is that there is an actual decomposition into real pure states that is the ensemble, and I would say that that's where the I think that's a mistake, and that the physics is actually telling us that because you have so many possible decompositions, and they all give you the same physics, that you actually don't have a unique decomposition.
I'm sorry to be dull. My friends always tell me that I'm always, you know, I'm really annoying. I'm always trying to make peace between them when they're fighting and jumping and arguing. But I agree with you, and I misspoke. In the following way, I said spectral decomposition mathematically canonical, but it needn't represent the physics. And what I should have said was, in the case where you really do have a bag of 1,000 systems, and you really know it's got subpopulations, which you may say never happens, but just imagining, as the tradition certainly does imagine, so in this sense I'm kind of reporting the tradition, that you can sometimes know that, then in that most easily understood case of the use of a density matrix, where there is that physically known decomposition, I am emphasizing that your density matrix might be not described that way. You might have, for example, spectrally resolved it. But when you emphasize we don't always have a physical, straightforward decomposition of that traditional type, I want to basically agree with you, because, of course, with Despagne, I want to say we need to take notice of the improper mixture concept.
Ah,
yeah.
Good question.
So that's a kind of piece, I hope.
Well, I'm sorry.
Nobody ever likes the piece I offer them. So you and I have to fight it out.
It's sick. I'll give you that.
This really reminds me of a discussion on that basis of the vector space is not unique. Or am I missing the completely? Am I missing the point completely?
It's true. That's part of it. But that's a very general statement. Okay, many bases. So we can, of course, represent an operator in any basis, perhaps an inconvenient one in which it's not diagonal,
yeah,
even though it's self-adjoint.
When you do the spectrocomposition of your density matrix, that you get it some basis.
Exactly.
Because you can't identify the eigenspaces,
yes,
some operator or some measurement apparatus in your lab.
No, the point is that you can decompose your density operator into a convex combination of pure states, or not even pure states, of other mixtures.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You can decompose your density operator into an infinite number of ways, where each way is some convex combination of other states, whether pure or mixed. And so, I mean, the fact that you can the spectral decomposition is one way, and if all the eigenvalues are unique, then it's a unique way of decomposing it, but it's not. It's only unique up to that choice that you made, that you wanted to have, if it's an n-dimensional system, you want n projectors summed together. But you can write it in an infinite number of other ways as well, which all appear like these, you call them improper mixtures. I would just call them mixtures and just say that the density operator is what determines the physics. And that all this stuff about, whether it's actually this mixture of pure states or this other mixture of mixed states or a mixture of pure states and mixed states or whatever is irrelevant. And that all the distinctions between them are artificial and shouldn't be discussed. Now, you would disagree with that, and that's okay. That's where the disagreement is.
Okay.
I think
more generally, that's the basis.
Sorry, somebody wanted to say something?
I'm saying, I think even preparation of the same density matrix can be distinguished.
No.
I mean, preparation is
If it prepares the same density matrix, you can't distinguish it.
I think I've really seen the first of that.
If you get the same density matrix out of it, it doesn't matter where you got it. If you get the density matrix out of an apparatus, I don't care where it comes from. I mean, it shows up as that density matrix. You can't figure out how it was prepared.
No, this is the tradition, that you might nevertheless know something, because your lab technician told you, this is a bag of 1,000, of which 250 are in psi, 250 are in phi, and 500 are in chi. And then, the density matrix won't report that to you, but
that's
you
right.
could know it anyway. It's the tradition.
Okay, I see what you're saying. That it could have been prepared in two different ways.
Right.
And my point is that, yes, it could have been prepared in two different ways, but so what? I mean, you could start, whether I know how it was prepared or not, as long as I know what the state is, I can make accurate predictions of all measurement results. And so the preparation is actually not important. And this is where we disagree.
Fortunately, Professor Fuchs is going to resolve all these things. At least it's pretty
fantastic. I'm just going to add fuel to the fire.
In the following way, in the spirit of getting a very broad overview of everything the jury wants to say, I suggest we waylay the debate. We just chew upon it. We think about it. We put it in our stomachs and we have it later. And so that we can see the whole story.
I deliberately leant against the board because I'm, back against the wall. okay, well, I only have 2 minutes now, and which, has its merits, actually, because I think it's far better to discuss these things rather than cover material. I guess I won't do my slides about the proper and improper mixture formally. I just want to give you the sort of formal punchline, just to put two things up that are bound to come up again. And again, as probably you've seen it, and that's appropriate because it's the end and it's been a long morning. You're familiar with the idea then that an arbitrary pure state for a bipartite system can be represented in this kind of way. Well, I picked a basis of phi and psi in the left and right systems. The so-called Schmidt decomposition tells you that, in fact, there are bases. They might not be the ones you first thought of, so let's call them phi tilde and psi tilde, in which you can make a single expansion, right, over a single index. And I just want to make the comment then that this has Well, I want to make two comments, really. First of all, I want to connect this to my concept of improper mixture. And then just to throw in a little something that rounds up some themes, I'm going to make a comment about the modal interpretation. So first of all, I just want to make the remark that this kind of so-called bi-orthogonal expression is actually what you get in naive models of non-disturbing measurement of the type we had with our momentum measurement analog of Schrödinger cat. You trigger the system with a micro system in this sort of a state, and you have some kind of ready state, R naught, but the evolution sends the entire thing into this correlated, entangled state. And, without those. And then you notice that these bases, micro-observable being measured and point of position, are actually bases of the type you want for this decomposition. And you can then ask, well, what does this kind of Schmidt decomposition determine as the reduced state or density matrix that describes the components? And actually, when you do the maths of this, you find that the answer is, writing it now in the Dirac notation, that the left system is in this. That is the density matrix. And the right system is in this, the density matrix is this. Now the point about this is that you've got the Born rule probabilities mod di squared associated to the various components of your mixture. And it looks really groovy, as we children of the 60s used to say, perhaps we still say in moments of weakness, like at the end of a bit of lecturing, a little bit of cognitive failure there, sorry, not really up to me. It's what I'd call groovy in my here in my old age up at the front, and it looks great. But I want to worry that it's an improper mixture, right, for the reasons we've discussed. It looks like the pointer has got into a mixture with Born rule weights for being in the various position eigenstates. It looks like the microsystem has had a non-selective projection postulate measurement on it. But these are improper mixtures, and I'm still worried about the measurement problem. The final comment then, and then I'll shut up, is that the modal interpretation in a version by Cochin, famous Cochin, and by Deeks, and by Richard Healy in the kind of 1985 to 1995 version of modal interpretation is based on this kind of result. They say there are extra values. They're not like the pilot wave, given once and for all that it is position that has extra values as a beginning move that is true throughout the interpretation. It's rather the quantity that is definite in value depends upon the state. And when you are in this, the pointer is definite. And when you are in this, then this micro-observable is definite. So I'd just like to make the remark that this kind of exploitation of the Schmidt bi-orthogonal doesn't just occur to discuss the proper and improper mixture, and it doesn't just occur in a lot of technical stuff in quantum information theory. It also is exploited in one of the interpretations we've mentioned today. Okay, I better shut up. Thank you.